You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 161 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Artistic Sensitivity as a Spiritual Approach to Knowing Life and the World, translated by Rory Bradley. Lecture 5 was given in Dornach on February 5, 1915. During this time when death seems to surround us, I would like to touch upon a few spiritual scientific matters connected with the problem of death. Today I would like to offer a sort of introduction to these issues, then speak in more detail about several things connected with the theme tomorrow. And then on Sunday we will make the transition from these problems to more general questions of an artistic conception of life, which in turn will lead us back to some considerations of our building here. If we want to turn our attention toward the experiences connected with the problem of death, we must above all be clear that people are generally unaware of their own being, of the things that are woven in as part of that being. They are unaware not only of the deeper aspects of their true hidden being, but also of many things that play a very significant role in their everyday experiences. We must be clear that when it comes to the most important organs of knowledge that we have in the physical world, that is, our senses, we see things almost exclusively from the outside. And when we see things from the outside, like this, what we might call our skin actually acts as a barrier to seeing our actual, true human nature. And whenever we assess our actual true human nature, whenever we want to gain some picture of this true human essence, we must make use of our understanding and our imaginative capacity. But this understanding, this imaginative capacity, is very heavily influenced during the course of the development that we carry out in our physical body by both Aramonic and Luciferic forces. And all of these influences that are exercised upon our understanding by both Lucifer and Ahriman tend to cloud our self-assessment and judgment quite severely. When it comes to human self-knowledge in our time, things are most often like they were in the example that I mentioned in our lecture last time. The university professor who told the story about walking along the street as a young man and suddenly encountering a young man who had a face that the professor found simply horrible, only to be shocked by the discovery that he had actually seen his own reflection, because of the position of two mirrors that had presented his own physiology to him. We can see that he had absolutely no idea how he looked physiologically, and his features actually struck him as quite unpleasant. I also mentioned a second similar instance that the professor had mentioned. But things are no different when it comes to what we might call our more exact self-knowledge. The I, capital, and astral body accompany us along the path journeying into the cosmos when we have moved through the gate of death. But these withdraw from view during our physical life. For when we awaken, the I and astral body do not reveal themselves to us. They do not show themselves to us in their true forms, but rather in the forms that are reflected by the pictures of the I and astral body projected from the physical body and the etheric body. Of course, we would see the eye and astral body in their true forms during the time between falling asleep and waking up, but for the fact that we are in an unconscious sleeping state. Even the dreams that we have in normal life are poor representatives of our essence, because they are only reflections of things from the etheric body that are then more fully developed by the astral body. Also, we first need to actually understand the language of dreams in order to arrive at the correct interpretation. If we do understand the language of dreams, then we are indeed able to gain knowledge about our true being from the processes that play out there. But in our usual lives, we are accustomed to simply taking up the images that dreams offer us. But this makes about as much sense as simply taking up the letters in a written text and describing their shape, rather than reading the words that they form. During our life between birth and death, our true being and essence withdraws from us. We must be clear about the fact that all of the feelings and the emotions of the will that bring about our actions and dealings, as well as our judgments and concepts, lie within the astral body and the eye. There, in the depths of our being, where the astral body and eye reside, is a whole world of emotions, a world of feelings and impulses of the will. But the actual view that we have of these emotions, will impulses, and feelings in everyday life is really only distantly connected, quite distantly, with what we truly are inwardly. Let us consider the following. It can certainly happen in life that two people encounter one another or live with one another for a long time. And because of the particular forces that are at work in the unknown astral bodies and egos of these two people, these forces remain hidden, after all. These particular forces might cause one person to have a peculiar desire to torment the other, a certain sort of need for cruelty. Now, it can happen that the individuals who have this desire to torment or this need for cruelty have no idea about the emotions in the astral body and the eye, and so, instead, they build up a whole set of ideas about the things that result from their need for cruelty. Ideas that explain their actions on the basis of something entirely different than this need. Such people might tell you that they did something to the other person for one reason or another. These reasons might even be very sharp-witted, but they are not expressions of the truth. The concepts that we use as motives for our actions, or even for our emotions, are completely removed from the things that are truly interwoven within our being. Yes, it can be the case that luciferic powers hinder the ability of the person in question to become clear about his or her own need for cruelty, the need to inflict all manner of things upon the other person. And under the influence of this luciferic power, everything that such individuals say about the reasons for their actions is there only to spread a cover, a mask, over the things that truly exist in their soul. The reasons that we consciously state can often be meant to hide or to camouflage from us the things that are truly interwoven and active in our soul. Often the reasons also come out of a desire to defend ourselves from ourselves. Otherwise, we would seem as unappealing to ourselves as the professor's physiognomy was to himself. Readers aside, I think before when it said physiology, that they may in fact have been the word physiognomy. talking about facial features. End of Reader's Aside. Here it's, sorry, Reader's Aside again. Here it does say, in fact, physiognomy, so I'm mentioning that. End of Reader's Aside. In our soul, it would make us unappealing to ourselves if we had to admit the desires and emotions that actually exist there. And because it is necessary for us to protect ourselves from looking upon the true essence of our own soul, we invent, with Lucifer's help, all sorts of things that offer us protection, that shield us from this by anesthetizing us against the things that are really there, interwoven throughout our soul. Just as it is the case that the things that appear to us in the external world become a maya through the unique qualities of our imaginative capacity, so too is it the case that the things we tell ourselves about ourselves are generally a maya in everyday life. Certain desires and needs of the inner being in particular always cause us to deceive ourselves about this true essence. For example, we have a person who is vain and conceited, one who suffers from a certain need for status. There is certainly no shortage of people like this in the world. We readily admit this. But if we did not place a mask over the things that we actually carry within our soul, we would go on to admit that such a need for status exists in many, many souls, including many who do not suspect that about themselves at all. Many people wish for more status, but when I say that they wish for it, please understand that this wish does not rise to the level of consciousness. This wish remains deep below the surface. People like this might wish to have a predominant influence on someone else, but because they would have to admit that this drive to influence that person bespeaks a vain need for status, they do not admit to it. Instead, they have to appeal, unconsciously, of course, to that allure, that power to mislead, that Lucifer is capable of exercising on the human soul in secret. And under the unconscious influence of Lucifer, such a person never says to himself, quote, "This thing that is inside of me, which creates this desire to rule over others, is nothing more than a vain need for status, close quote. These people never say this to themselves. Instead, under Lucifer's influence, they often invent a whole system to explain their feelings, which they feel somehow to be dark, even though they do not admit to their true nature. So it is that a person like this feels certain things toward someone or another, but cannot admit to himself that he actually wants to dominate that person, and is perhaps unable to, because that person does not allow himself to be dominated. And so the soul that is under Lucifer's influence invents a system. He invents a system that tells him that the other individual in question actually has ill intentions toward him, and the system lays out all of these ill intentions in detail. He feels persecuted by these other people. But this whole system of judgments and concepts is a mask. It is only there to cover up the things that are not supposed to come up from out of the depths of the inner soul life, to encase them in a kind of shell, a true maya. Once a man told me a whole string of things that he had done, and said that he had undertaken all of them out of a deep sense of duty, out of total commitment to the cause that he was championing. I had to contradict him. Quote, "All of the opinions you have about the motivations for your actions are entirely inconsequential. The only thing that is of consequence when it comes to making a judgment about human behavior, is reality, and not the opinions that people have about their own actions. Close quote. In this case, reality demonstrated that the cause of his actions was the drive, the inclination to gain influence in a particular area. I said to this person, quote, though you believe that you acted out of a deep sense of duty, you actually acted out of a need, an egotistical drive to gain influence. And now you are reinterpreting these actions as ones done selflessly, purely out of a sense of duty. You are not interpreting things this way because that is how they truly are, but rather because you get pleasure out of these thoughts, because you delight in them. Again, this comes out of a certain egotistical drive. Close quote. The things that live and move in our souls can be extremely complicated and are often not the least bit similar to the opinions and imaginations that we have of them. It can be very, very complicated. You will readily admit that you have to know this if you really want to live in a world of truth and not a world of Maya, and you also have to speak out about it, sometimes in a radical fashion. The reasons that we are really and truly led to do the things we do will only gradually become clear to us when we learn to really recognize, through spiritual science, the connections between the human being and the world. Let us take a specific example. You all know that there are people in the world commonly referred to as windbags. You all know that there are people in the world who might be referred to as such. If you were to ask one of these windbags why they all get together in a little coffee klatch or somewhere else and talk so much, they often talk about a lot more than they can account for later. If you ask someone like this such questions, you will hear any number of reasons why it is important that they talk about one thing or another. You can talk with people you encounter on the street who are hurrying off to one of these groups, trying to get there as quickly as possible. And when you learn about what they are going to talk about, you will see that usually they are driven to talk about the most vain, most useless, dumbest chatter imaginable. And if you ask them why this is so important, you will hear reasons that sound incredibly beautiful, nice, and magnificent. In any case, they are very inclined to obscure the truth of the matter. Now, let us point out this truth of the matter. What happens when we gossip? And when we just talk, the same thing happens, of course. What happens there? Now, you see, we are using the organs of our breath, our organs of speech, to put air in motion, in forms that correspond to words. Within ourselves, we generate these physical waves. And so it goes without saying that we also generate the corresponding etheric waves, because whenever we speak, something very significant happens in the etheric body. We generate physical waves, the air waves, and then the etheric waves that correspond to our words and lend them the force of expression. Just imagine that, quite exactly, for a moment. While you sit there, while a person sits there with his coffee cup in front of him on the table, he sets an entire inner organism in motion, the inner organism that corresponds to the expressive form, the external physical and etheric expressive forms of his words. Indeed, he has something that lives and moves within himself. He generates that internally. But he also senses it. He perceives it. He perceives this movement of the physical and etheric bodies, because the astral body and the eye are in continual contact with them. The astral body is in continual contact with waves of the etheric and becomes aware of them. And the eye, capital, is in continual contact with the physical waves of the air. So the astral body and the eye are constantly making contact and butting up against something when we speak. Through this contact, we become aware of the eye and of the astral body, and this is the greatest of human pleasures, the ability to take delight in oneself. In this contact between the astral body, the etheric body, the eye, and the physical body, something occurs that is similar to what happens when a child sucks on a piece of candy. The refreshing and pleasant feeling of sucking on candy comes from the fact that the astral body is coming into contact with a process of the physical body. And through this contact, a person becomes aware of himself. We become aware of ourselves through such processes. We take delight in ourselves. When people are in a hurry to sit down at the coffee table and gossip for an hour or two, the truth is that they are hurrying toward self-enjoyment. Self-enjoyment is what people look for there. One cannot become aware of such things if one does not know that the human being is a being with four parts, and all four parts participate in all the activity of the external world. Something else can also be there in a different way. In the example I just mentioned of the coffee clatch, we can see this in the way that people have a drive to enjoy themselves through the contact of the astral body and the etheric body, the eye and the physical body. But people also often have a need to make contact simply between the astral body and the etheric body. In this case, the etheric body has to generate movement, to generate inner activity, in such a way that the astral body can make contact with it. Such things happen much more than other things in the unconscious. People have a drive to make contact between the etheric body and the astral body, which we are not actually conscious of. This drive is lived out in the most curious ways. For example, we often see young men, though recently it also happens with young women, who simply cannot rest until they see their words in print. It is sometimes an incredibly wonderful feeling to see your words in print, but it is a wonderful feeling primarily because, in seeing yourself in print, you often give yourself over to the terrible illusion that you will also be read. Now, it is not always the case that you are read, just because you have been printed, but you believe it anyway, and this creates an altogether wonderful feeling. And some men, and as I said, young women too, simply cannot rest and are always unsettled until the day their work is printed. What does that mean? Well, you see, if we are printed and then actually read, which happens very seldom these days, as we all know, then our thoughts are carried over into another person and live on in that other person's soul. And these thoughts live in the etheric bodies of the others. Then the feeling takes hold in us that what we ourselves had in the etheric body as a thought is now alive out there in the world. We have the feeling that out there in the world our own thoughts are alive. If they are really out there, if they really exist out there, which is to say, if our printed text is actually read, then this also influences our own etheric body, and we bump up against what lives out there in the world. This is a very different kind of contact than when we simply bump up against our own thoughts. People do not always have the strength for it, because it requires a certain amount of energy to take these thoughts out of one's being and essence. But when your thoughts live out there, when you can have in your consciousness the idea that your thoughts are living out in the world, then your astral body bumps up against the things that you put out there in the external world. At least we believe this to be the case. This generates a sense of self-enjoyment. This sense of self-enjoyment lies at the root of everyone's desire for fame, the desire to be known, the desire for prestige. At the root of this drive toward self-enjoyment is nothing other than a need to experience contact between our astral body and the objectified thoughts of our etheric body, and through this contact to become aware of ourselves. So you can see what a complicated process it is, one that plays out between astral and etheric bodies, which lies at the root of something that plays a considerable role in the external world. I have, of course, not said these things in the interest of setting them up as some kind of moralizing scarecrow in your souls. It was certainly not intended as such. For everything that I have just described is part of the normal features of life. It is simply self-evident that when we speak, we enjoy ourselves, even if our speaking is not idle gossip. It is also self-evident that when we print something, even if it is because we feel obligated to say something to the world and not because of a desire for fame, we encounter the thoughts of our own etheric body. The same process is at work. So we should not conclude that we should always try to escape these processes or understand them to be fundamentally immoral, because I mean all of this symbolically. If you try to escape everything that comes toward you from both Ahriman and Lucifer, and I mean this symbolically, as soon as you became aware of anything coming toward you, you would have to get out of your own skin. It goes without saying that Lucifer and Ahriman have no other effects on us than those which are also fully normal realities of human life, except that Lucifer and Ahriman perform them in obscure ways, as I have spoken about in various lecture cycles. If you hold all of this up before your soul, then you will see how endlessly complex and multifaceted the threads are that play out between human souls, and also between human souls and the world. But at the same time, you will say to yourself that people really have such a limited understanding from the things that they perceive and imagine about this relationship between people and the world. What we imagine about ourselves is really such a tiny piece of what we really experience, and this imagination is largely a maya. Only by making spiritual science into a true resource for life, and not merely a theory, will we be able to get behind the maya and enlighten ourselves about the things that constantly work within us. But the fact that we have only a small, largely untrue, piecemeal understanding of the worldwide web into which we are woven does not change anything. Things simply are as they are. All of these hidden forces, this hidden web that links human souls to one another and to the various agents of the world, all of that is there and is at play in every waking and sleeping minute of human life. And from that, you can assess how much work there is to do in order to arrive at a true knowledge of the human being. But it is part of the feeling that we need to correctly perceive things that belong not to earthly incarnation, but to eternity and the infinite, that we engage in the sort of considerations that we have just undertaken. Because by creating this nuance of sensibility within ourselves, we become aware of what actually leads to the conflicts that arise in life. These conflicts that arise in life and that are properly the content of both poetry and art come from the fact that during life we are swimming in vast, unknown, and hidden waves of interconnection. We are aware of only a tiny, and largely false, piece of this expanse of connectivity. But we cannot live only according to this tiny piece that we are aware of. We must live with the entire soul, in relationship to the vast and multifaceted branches of life. And this is where the problem arises. How are we supposed to establish a proper relationship with what is really present in life? How are we supposed to properly understand what actually exists in life, when we have an awareness of only a tiny piece, which is also false in many cases? Because we are not able to understand, it often happens that we find ourselves in conflict with our own lives. But there, where reality lies, there lies also the truth. Reality does not follow along with the imaginations that we generate about it. And in the moment that the opportunity arises for this reality to be active, we see in countless instances that this reality usually relentlessly corrects the maya of our imaginations. And this sort of corrective that reality offers to the maya of our imagination presents a very significant set of reproaches for art and poetry. Following in the line of thought from today's considerations, I would like to take something artistic, specifically something poetic, as a starting point, with the intent to then move into a consideration of the life between death and a new birth in tomorrow's lecture. Then on Sunday, we will come to the artistic aspects in the broader sense of our building. I would like to begin with something artistic that has not been arbitrarily selected, but rather something that nicely exemplifies the knowledge of the reality of spiritual life that I have to describe. The example that I chose because in a small but truly excellent piece of art, the artist really hit upon reality. Only an occultist can assess whether this has happened, because in small pieces of art, we can see how a person, when attempting to penetrate into the deeper problems of life as an artist, often cannot help but touch upon the occult side of life that rises up from the depths in the conflicts that play out in life. The conflict that we often are unable to penetrate with the help of the maya of our consciousness. The thing that is important to me in an esoteric, artistic sense comes at the very end of a novella that I would like to offer simply as an example to you. Therefore, I will simply sketch out the beginning for you, and then I will read the final passage aloud. We are not doing this simply for the sake of talking about literature, but rather because in this specific case, a writer has described something according to the truest of esoteric laws that is in fact possible to describe. Since this novella was written back in the 1860s, you will ascertain from the facts that I am presenting that the things we speak about in spiritual science as needing to occur in the cultural movements on earth have actually always, in some sense, been reflected and prepared in human consciousness. And the things that are to become more fully conscious through spiritual science have always been reflected unconsciously in certain souls. Perhaps one of these souls was in fact somewhat conscious of it, but because the times were not yet right, he did not trust himself to bring this knowledge forward in any form other than in the unassuming guise of literature. Even now, people are much more forgiving when someone presents esoteric facts in the form of a novella or poem. In a materialistic age, people are much more ready to forgive than if someone simply steps forward and speaks the truth directly, claiming that such things are reality. If people can say to themselves, well, that is just a bit of fiction, they are somehow more ready to accept it. The novella is as follows. It is written as though one of the people, who is a character in the novella, also wrote it. It is a so-called I novella, capital I novella. This individual describes his friendship with Mademoiselle Manon de Gossin. The novella takes place in Paris, and then tells that he goes day after day to the house of this Mademoiselle de Gossin, who is a celebrated singer. He tells how he comes to know a wide variety of people who are admirers of this lady of the house, among them one man in particular, who is always, always there in Mademoiselle de Gossin's salon. But the narrator, in describing what happens in the novella, notices that the man in question has feelings for the woman that go beyond friendship, and he also becomes aware of the fact that the singer does not reciprocate his feelings. What plays out then, and it plays out in a wide variety of ways, is actually a conflict that arises because someone with a burning desire for the singer is there, and while his feelings are not reciprocated, he is also not simply thrown aside. He's actually drawn in more and more, which only causes him to become more and more unsettled and agitated. The narrator of the novella, who is not the author of the novella, it being a so-called I novella, notices this, and he means well for the other man. It needs to be mentioned that the narrator is engaged and is to be married in the following weeks, so there is, of course, no question of jealousy here. The narrator means well for the other man, and one day he lays things out for him. This opens the other man's eyes, and he feels compelled to have a conversation with the singer. The result of this exchange is that the man leaves the house and retreats to an area outside the city. But despite having resolved never to think of this woman again, to forget her and busy himself with whatever else he cannot manage it. He is unable to get out of that state of being unsettled. The thoughts that he had during his acquaintance with the woman keep playing over and over in his mind. He leaves the city and lives somewhere else for a time. During this time, the narrator gets married and has to go away on a trip. On this trip, he meets the other man at a hotel. The other man is in a terrible state. In the course of their conversation, the other man tells how he retreated from Paris, how he tried to live alone for a while, and then one day he went on a horseback ride beyond the grounds of his estate and unhappily encountered the woman's company, which was also traveling outside of Paris. This encounter brought all of his feelings back to life. Now he actually goes around with two revolvers, intending to end his life at the first opportunity. The narrator still means well for the other man, and invites him to the place where he has made his home, in the hope of being able to bring him around to different thoughts. The man accepts the invitation, which was intended to offer him a kind milieu as a guest in someone's home. But he cannot bring himself around, and he continues to sink lower and lower until he finally resolves to kill himself. The two friends talk with one another, and the narrator manages to convince him to delay for a little while. The narrator says that he has to go away on a trip, and because he does not want to say, quote, "Wait until I get back at least," close quote, the other man might not have listened, he might have shot himself in the meantime, he forces the other man to make a promise that will truly bind him. He says, "Protect my wife until I return." After the other man promises him this, he travels to Paris again with the intent to induce the singer to come to the country so that something might be done to bring his friend out of this desperate circumstance. So he goes into the city and returns to the country with the singer. They drive to the fence of the country house belonging to the narrator. At the moment they reach the fence, the narrator notices a man who had been standing at the gate go running off. They drive farther along the road toward the house. There is a shot. The other had kept his promise and guarded his wife truly. But he posted a watchman at the gate who was to inform him the moment that the traveler returned. The watchman said to him, "Now he is back." In that moment, the other man shot himself. So the narrator brings the singer into the house, and from this point forward, I would like to read you the words from the novella itself. Quote, "In the evening we arrived at the castle. I noticed that as we drove into the park, a farmer who had been waiting for us took off toward the castle like a bolt of lightning. We had barely driven halfway down the drive when there was a shot. In that moment I was so filled with the feeling of success at my undertaking that I did not understand the significance of that shot. The surprise was not long withheld from me. We drove on, and nobody came toward us. The coachman pulled up, and I sprang out, Gossin behind me. The first thing we heard was the shriek of my wife's lady-in-waiting, who rushed to us, pale as a corpse, crying, 'He has shot himself dead,' before sinking at our feet. We hurried to the Marquis's chambers, and the room was full of people. I waved them all out, shut the door, and stood with Manon alone beside the young man's corpse, which lay on the ground. She stared at him blankly for a few moments, then let out a cry and sank to her knees beside him on the floor. She grasped his hands, laid her own on his brow. The wound was on his breast. She looked up to me, down at him, and then began suddenly to sing out loudly. This filled me with a sense of horror. I believed she had gone mad. In the meantime, one of my stewards came by who knew something of the medicinal arts, and typically filled the role of the doctor when the risk was not too great. Never will I forget the look of deathly terror that was painted on his face when he glimpsed the pair on the floor, the dead Marquis and Gossin singing beside him. She fell silent then, stood up, gazed at me for a long time, and left the room. I followed her to attend to her needs. She said, 'I must have room to myself.' I led her to the first and best room available, fetched her lady-in-waiting, and hurried off to my wife. I heard to my delight that she had gone to take a walk and set off toward her, so that we might share the experience with one another. As the two of us had spoken often of the Marquis and had considered, among the many possibilities, that it might end in this way, she was less shocked than saddened. I accompanied her back to the castle and gave my orders regarding the Marquis. The corpse had been laid on a bed. His servant stood by him and wept bitterly, saying, 'My lord said to me that he would not shoot himself until you returned. That had calmed me. He had arranged with Jean in secret that he should watch out for the carriage. He did as he was told, and barely had he returned with the news that the carriage had driven into the park, when my lord stood up, made a note in the book he was reading, reached into his bag, and gave Jean a louis d'or, took his pistols from the table, and went into the other room. Not a moment had passed after he shut the door, and then he was dead.' I reproached myself. Perhaps I could have rescued him if I had written in more quickly. If Gossin had arrived on time, perhaps we might not have experienced this misfortune. I also thought that perhaps Providence had wanted to protect him from something even more terrible. For even if the singer had resolved to marry him, and I believe she might have, even though she had initially assured me of the contrary, such a step would not have been without its share of calamities, and might have resulted in a misery far worse than any other. I went to her. She was composed. You could not see the recent experience in her, so to speak. She spoke with me about the Marquis's temperament and his natural tendency toward such a tragic end. Although she was so composed, I sensed that the inner agitation she was experiencing was very strong, and I feared the after effects. I introduced her to my wife. We dined together, and then withdrew to our chambers. The next morning the change in her was remarkable. She said that she was doing well, but her appearance was so haggard, her bearing so disturbed, that the sight of her betrayed her claims. She spoke of leaving shortly and requested that a different room be prepared for her for the following night. This was done. We spent the day quietly, and she did not retire for the day until all of the arrangements had been made for her departure. The next day she did not come to breakfast. The lady-in-waiting bid me come to her lady at her bedside. She received me with a dull smile, and was so pale and hollow-looking that I was unable to conceal my shock. "Dear friend," she said, "you find my appearance unpleasant, and do not want to say it. Do you not find that a natural inclination? Yes, you are always so sensitive and reserved. But in this case concealing it will not help. I feel that death is upon me." "Dear friend," I cried out in horror, "I feel it, for I have seen the Marquis the last two nights. Waking, stepping here before me, he is pulling me to him." I considered her attentively. There was no sign of hysteria in her eyes, no madness in her voice. "When I saw him lying there in his own blood," she continued, "the feeling that I had caused this misfortune grew so powerful within me that I cried out, because I could bear it no longer. I felt as though something incredibly urgent was crying in my ear, 'The fault is yours, you have murdered him.' In order not to hear this voice, I began to sing ever louder, but I could not overpower the voice. I kept hearing it. That night I could not sleep. I lay there and gazed at the shadows cast by the furniture in the dim nighttime light. The door flew open and was nothing more than a thin, dim stripe. The Marquis slipped through it like a paper-thin smoke. He had his eyes closed and drifted or walked slowly toward me, stood beside my bed in person, just as you are now, but with closed eyes. I did not want to look at him, but he compelled me to. I had to turn my eyes toward him. Then he suddenly opened his own and gazed at me. I could not bear it. I lost consciousness. The night after, it was the same game. I cannot bear it much longer. I feel him sucking the life out of me with his eyes. I tried to explain away the apparition with every explanation of physics, philosophy, and religion, but she remained firm. "I have decided to leave," she said. "Perhaps his shadow is merely bound to this house." I was opposed to this. I could not allow her to travel alone, and I also could not abandon my wife to the trials that were facing us. Instead, I recommended that she move into my steward's house and promised to remain awake at her bedside the following night. She finally acquiesced to this and staggered about like a shadow. That evening, when she had laid herself down in bed, her lady-in-waiting called me to her. I set a table with a light on it beside her bed, set up a Spanish wall about it, and then began, after speaking with her for a short time, to read a book. She appeared to be sleeping. The lights burned low, and I cleaned them, drank some wine and water, and looked at the door. The door was made of old wood and was not secure. Suddenly it flew open. The latch must not have been properly closed. I made to move toward it, quietly to close it without a sound, when, turning toward Mademoiselle de Gossin in the bed, I saw her sitting bolt upright in bed with staring eyes. She stretched her arms toward me, grasping at mine, and pointing out straight with her finger, "There, he is coming." Nothing was to be seen. "Where?" I said. "There." I pulled myself free and stepped to the spot. "Here?" "Come," she cried, "he is standing in front of you." With one leap I was at her side. "Cover my eyes, I cannot bear it. He is standing right there, he is touching your knee." I pressed both my hands to her eyes. Her breathing was ragged, but there was nothing to be done. After a while she pulled my hands away. "I must see if he is still there," she said quietly. "There is nothing here, dear friend," I replied, letting go of her. She glanced about. "He is gone again. Oh, if only he were to come a few more times like that, things will soon be happier for me. We will slip out arm and arm through the door." This idea made me shudder. She laid back in bed and declared that she would surely depart the next day and would go to a cloister. I tried to talk her out of this. "Go to Paris," I said. "There you will forget." "I have earned it," she interrupted. "And that you would ever suggest such a thing, I have earned that too. I will never forget. Him, perhaps, if he ever ceases to torment me, but not my guilt. That has been welded to me tightly." "There is no guilt to speak of," I said. "It was coincidence that he loved you, and you could do nothing to change that you did not love him. It was only natural, based on his dissimulations, that you would believe him to be cured of it." "Oh," she cried, "can a mother who has let her child fall into the water ever forgive herself? You believe that guilt comes only from ill will? Would it not then be possible to wash away all remorse through an appeal to greater necessity? When God makes us guilty of an act, he also wills that we must bear its consequences. It has been decreed that I shall always hear the rattling of these chains." I had quickly exhausted my counter-arguments. She left the castle, and I did not accompany her. The birth of a son tore me away from all depressing thoughts. I threw a party in honor of this happy occasion. The baptism, the first stages of raising the child, the tending to my wife, all of these occupied me so fully that anyone might find it understandable that I did not make any further inquiries about the beautiful and unhappy being to whom my thoughts turned from time to time. One time I received a package from Paris that had been given to my managing director there, addressed to me. It comprised an étui and a letter, both sealed. I broke the seal on the latter first. It was only a few lines. "Dear friend, by the time you have this in your possession, I shall be no more. I knew that the Marquis would call me to him. Though he did not come again to disturb my nights, I carried something within my soul that took his place. Tell your bride that I have no happier memory than that of her kindness toward me. Protect your son against people like me. Grant the small picture that I have enclosed a small and quiet place. You do not need to break the seal. I do not want it destroyed. It should not come into the wrong hands. When you look upon it, please think of me, and perhaps believe I had a heart, after all. Manon de Gesson." I opened the étui, and the unhappy girl who had just informed me of her recent death looked up at me, possessing all of the enchantment that was hers during her most beautiful days. The tears welled up in my eyes, and I recalled all of the happy hours that I spent in her home. Close quote. Steiner again. Today we have here a very accurate description of how the etheric body of someone who has died can appear before another person, a very accurate description indeed. Immediately following the man's death, Manon de Gesson saw the wandering etheric body of the dead man. Today I simply wanted to show you how this sort of apparition was worked through in a novella from the 1860s. Tomorrow we will continue with a consideration of the appearance of the etheric body of a dead individual and what this can teach us about the secret hidden relationships that exist between people. Try to feel that there is a vast realm that is at play behind the tiny piece of reality, the Maya, that was present in the Manon de Gossin's consciousness. Try to feel that the things that played out as her encounters with the etheric body of the dead man in the hours following his death arose on the waves that emanate outward from this vast hidden realm. Indeed, this human etheric body has a deeper and more inward relationship to the various conditions into which we are woven in the cosmos than it does to our own self-knowledge and consciousness. The end of Lecture 5.